Asheville Free Media, ashevillefm.org. This is The Final Straw and Bursts of Goodness. The show can also be heard on KXCF in Marshall, California, KWTF out of Bodega Bay, California, KOWALP out of Olympia, Washington, and WCRSLP in Columbus, Ohio. Archives of the show can be found a week after airing at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org, and you can contact us for comments or questions at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net. This week on The Final Straw, Burst spoke with Dalar Durek. Dalar is a Kurdish refugee living in Germany who's a PhD candidate studying and working around issues connected with the Kurdish women's movement and the PYD, or Democratic Union Party, in the Rojava territories within the borders of Syria. But first, we have some official business to engage with. Because Sean Swain talked about his campaign for governor last week, the federal elections commissioners demand that The Final Straw provide Ohio Governor Jay Wow equal time, so Sean must yield the next five-minute segment to Governor Jay Wow. Democratic candidate Ed something or other was also offered equal time, but in an email response said, quote, "Why bother? I have no chance of winning," unquote. So, for equal time, here's Governor Jay Wow, not someone doing a comic imitation of him.
Thing on. Testing. Okay. My fellow Ohioans, my fellow Americans, my fellow humans, and I guess that includes all you filthy, scruffy anarchists out there who don't plan on voting for me anyway. Suck it. I've got a script here, But I'm feeling pretty loose. I didn't know I wasn't supposed to down those painkillers with alcohol, so I slugged them down with a bottle of vodka, and I feel great. Also, you should know, behind this podium, totally naked. Last week, the idiot who normally rambles through this segment talked about running for governor. He said, "I'm obsessed with his penis." And previously, the bomb-throwing moron claimed that I have unprotected sex with dogs and fireworks behind the Masonic Lodge. I would like to dispel all of those nasty slanders, as well as tell you all about what I've done for the last 4 years since Ed What's-His-Name can't beat me. Hey, Ed, suck it. First, those nasty slanders, for the record. I am not obsessed with Sean Swain's penis. I'm obsessed with the penis on his anatomically correct action figure. That doll is hung like a mule. Sean Swain in real life has a mundane human penis, and we have satellite photos to prove it. As to the claims that I have unprotected sex with dogs while blasting fireworks behind the Masonic Lodge, what Sean is implying is totally outrageous. One, they don't even make condoms for dogs. And C, fireworks are perfectly legal in Ohio. So, having cleared all that up, let's talk about my leadership in Ohio for the last 4 years. I came into office with four major goals. First, bring in corporations that pay millions to get puppets like me elected so those corporations can get huge tax breaks while employing a bunch of you ungrateful rabble. And that way, the corporations, they live like Johns, and I'm like the pimp, and you all, you unfortunates, are basically slave wage prostitutes. Suck it. B, I wanted to downsize the government through outsourcing to the private sector, which means giving my rich corporate buddies gravy contracts to take over functions the government used to do. That way, the corporations that don't answer to you run your government. And they can tell you to suck it, too. Fourth, I wanted to contract natural resources to corporations like frackers who will toxify your environment and turn it into a lifeless moonscape, giving your stupid kids cancer while getting themselves filthy rich. Dirty, filthy rich. Some of my best friends are frackers. Dirty, filthy frackers. So for the last 4 years, we've been fracking up your world. Oh yeah, F. I wanted to leave office wealthy so my kids can get Ivy League educations that all of your little brats can't afford. making sure that my kids will rule your kids the same way that I rule you. Hey! Hey, knock it! Hey, I'm on a roll here! My campaign staff get nervous when I'm naked. Where was I? Oh, yeah. I rule you and my kids will rule your kids, and that's how it goes. I play golf with the rich and powerful privileged elite, and you don't. So know your place. I mean, remember Kent State? That's nothing. We got drones now. Drones. So for the next 4 years, I will continue to drive down your wages, intoxify your world, and enrich my wealthy friends any way that I can. And you will sit there and take it. It's what you people do. It's what you've always done. And when I leave office with pockets full of cash, I'll go join one of those corporations that I enriched. And one of those corporations' managers will maybe come and run for office as a new sock puppet to continue sticking it to you. Or I might get a chance to take my show on the road to Washington, D.C., as a president or vice president, then I can do the same thing on a much larger scale. And don't even act like you're mad. If you were gonna do something about it, you already would have, okay? Just keep dragging stones up the side of the pyramid. Vote for me, and then shut up. This is Governor J-Wow, destined to get reelected November 3rd, and I approve this message, so suck it. These painkillers rock!
You could write to Sean Swain at Sean Swain, number 243-205, OSP, 878 Coitsville-Hubbard Road, Youngstown, Ohio, 44505. To read some of Sean's writings and learn more about his case, check out seanswain.org. Can you tell listeners who you are and a little bit about yourself? Where are you from? What do you do? And why do you do it?
Yes, so I'm Gilad Derek, and I'm currently, well, both a full-time activist, I guess, and also I'm a full-time student and working on my PhD at the University of Cambridge. And my research focus is the Kurdish women's movement, actually. And in my research, I compare different Kurdish parties' stance or attitudes towards patriarchy with their attitudes towards different institutions of power, such as nationalism, the state, and capitalism. And for instance, more concretely, I compare the system that is currently trying to be established in Rojava in the West Kurdistan, the Syrian part of Kurdistan, with the semi-autonomous government that exists in Iraqi Kurdistan. And I think we can see two very opposing systems there, especially with regards to their attitudes towards patriarchy, but they're also linked with their attitudes towards different institutions of power, such as whether or not they consider statehood a principle that is worth fighting for or not, and things like that. So I'm Kurdish myself. I was born in the Turkish part of Kurdistan, and I moved to Germany with my parents when I was three. We were refugees. So I grew up here in Europe, and I got my education in the States and then in the UK, my academic and my university education. So I'm trying to balance both my academic work, my research, with my activism. I'm active in the Kurdish women's movements, but also just generally in the Kurdish movements, if you will. And I do many translations, organizing, and so on. So I don't really have one specific thing that I do. I also write articles. So I do whatever I can, especially now in these times with the situation, especially in Kobani and generally in Rojava. There are many things to do, so sometimes it's very difficult to balance your studies with the with all the stuff that is going on in the world. And the reason I do it is because, well, I think, first of all, just generally as a matter of principle, people shouldn't look away when they see injustice. But in my case, I'm a product of this war. I'm a result of, my growing up here in Europe, my identity as a refugee is the result of a very bloody conflict. And I have lost family members. I have family members being tortured in prison, people being killed, and so on. So I was exposed to politics at a very early age, unconsciously, I guess. So my life has always been very politicized, which is the case with many Kurdish people who have been displaced or who have experienced the war in one way or another. And also, why I have been especially focusing on the women's liberation movement is also, well, I guess being a Kurdish woman myself has a lot to do with it, but also when on January 9th, 2013, three Kurdish women activists, Sakine Can, Sıskı Dandoğan, and Leyla Şaylamaz were murdered in the heart of Paris. That really influenced me because I knew two of these women personally. So then that's when I decided to increase my own activism as well. And then also I decided to do a PhD on this topic because I thought that this is something that I can do and that would be a good contribution to a cause as well. So I don't see a separation between my academic work or my activist work.
Would you give some context to folks in the listening audience about the Kurdish liberation movement, in particular in Rojava, and what changes it's experienced in the recent past, in particular the last decade and a half, and again in the last 2 years?
Well, first of all, it is important to know that there is not one Kurdish liberation movement, because, the Kurdish people are people that live across four different states, and therefore they have been subject to different kinds of oppression and discrimination, so not the same political culture developed everywhere. But what I'm going to be focusing on is the Kurdish movement affiliated with the PKK, because that plays the biggest role with regards to Rojava and generally about the things that we will probably be talking about in this interview. Well, the PKK started in the late 70s in Turkey with a group of university students, a rather elite circle, if you will, around Abdullah Öcalan and his friends, who were disillusioned by the Turkish left, actually, which failed to address the Kurdish question in Turkey as a class issue, because Kurds are not only ethnically discriminated, but they're also socioeconomically obviously disadvantaged. The Kurdish question is also a class question. But the Turkish left at that time failed to see the specificity of the situation of the Kurds. So then there was this need of the within the Kurdish left to organize independently. But at that time, the PKK started out with the aim of an independent Kurdistan, a state called Kurdistan, because the reasoning behind that was that, well, we are in such a situation, we're subject to so much oppression, discrimination, because of our stateless status. So the fact that we are stateless, that is the reason why we are oppressed. So if we create our own state, we will get rid of that oppression. So, and then the war escalated, and there were many years of fighting, and only later on, in the late 90s, there was a shift in the general PKK that moved away from the state. And it wasn't actually the whole movement that shifted, but more specifically the thought of Abdullah Öcalan, who in his time in prison, well, he was imprisoned in 1999, but also before that started to challenge the idea of the state as the ideal liberationist project. Well, this general shift had also a lot to do with, you know, the collapse of the Soviet Union, the collapse of many former classical leftist movements and so on, but also with the fact that the Öcalan got imprisoned, and also the experience of women in the liberation movement at that time. Because, as I said, the PKK started out among university students. So in the 80s, when the war intensified, when the Turkish army destroyed many villages in Kurdistan, actually 5,000 villages were destroyed, it drew many of the people in the rural areas, many people who were socioeconomically disadvantaged, who were who did not have the same education as the first circle of the PKK. They were also shaped by the more feudal patriarchal structures of the rural areas. So at that time, the women experienced a backlash in their expectations because they connected the PKK also with women's liberation. So at that time, they experienced some difficulties. So in the 90s, when this general shift away from the state paradigm emerged, at the same time, the women's movement started to organize itself autonomously. So the late 90s were a time of restructuring, of rethinking and redrawing within the PKK movement that tried to start to look for an alternative. So this alternative was later on termed by Abdullah Öcalan as democratic confederalism, which is supposed to be an alternative to the state, which is a mechanism of getting rid of the state, or at least of the power of the state, to make the state meaningless, the borders meaningless, by establishing an alternative system based on councils, cooperatives, and so on. So basically, parallel structures, which are not supposed to resemble the state, though, based on the principles of grassroots, radical grassroots democracy, gender equality, and ecology. Because the movement identified certain things such as the state, nationalism, patriarchy, capitalism, as the main sources of oppression, of the main reasons why the not only the Kurds, but people everywhere are oppressed in the way they are. That is why they saw that we cannot create an alternative, a solution, by just establishing the same system ourselves. So that is why an alternative was trying to be achieved. So, the principle is democratic confederalism, which is, as I said, based on councils from the city to the village to the neighborhood levels, where in which the women's movement is autonomously organized. So you have these people's councils, but you also have women's councils, you have cooperatives, you have alternative educational structures, you have communes, etc. So this has been trying to be implemented in Turkey, in the north of Kurdistan, but of course due to the oppression and the repression by the state of Turkey, this could only happen within the limits of the state. So this is problematic for two reasons, because on one hand, this movement aims at making the state meaningless, but at the same time, the state is so authoritarian, it puts 10,000 people in jail when this democratic autonomy movement started. So this is a distinction that I wanted to make. Democratic autonomy is the active implementation of the principles of democratic confederalism. The confederalism element suggests that this is a system that spreads across larger areas and so on. So whereas these active steps, the creating of communes, of cooperatives, etc., these are democratic autonomy. So in Turkey, the people tried to establish these structures, and they did. But as I've said, especially in 2009, when the KJK, is the new organizational form of the PKK, if you will, it means the Union of Communities of Kurdistan, which also suggests a shift away from, you know, just being a party to a movement, to a social movement. In the KJK process, which was the process of, you know, anti-terrorism, separatism, in which 10,000 people were arrested in 2009 by the Turkish state for these democratic autonomy projects. This, of course, was a big threat to the people. That meant, well, if you try to establish that, we will put you in jail. So you establish a school, a council, and that means you're being a terrorist because you're violating the integrity of the state. But people were still not discouraged from it. They actually became even stronger after that. So at the moment, the Kurdish parties in Turkey, they have this principle inspired by the PKK of co-presidency, which means that one woman and one man have to share the chair. This happens from the high-level party top to the level of how neighborhood councils are organized. So in each structure, in each administrative level, you have co-presidents. But of course, this is not recognized by the state. For example, when the municipal elections took place in the spring of this year, the Kurdish party, well, it was then still called pro-Kurdish party, but it does not call itself that. It restructured itself as well. I can perhaps elaborate on that later, but they insisted instead of having co-presidents in their municipalities. So officially, even though one person was elected, because they could only put one person on the ballot due to the structure of the state, they arranged that two people will always govern. They will split the salary, they will split the power, and two people will always govern the municipality. So people try to do it in spite of the state. So this is a very, very slow, but in a way, radical and efficient way of making the state's power in the region meaningless, and has actually inspired people across Turkey, non-Kurdish people across Turkey, that sympathize with this. So the support for this party got bigger, for example, in places such as Istanbul, where the Gezi Park protests were taking place, for example. In Rojava, it was easier to establish this kind of system because of the fact that the Syrian regime, the Assad regime, withdrew from the area in 2012 because they needed their troops elsewhere. So then the people who before that had to get permission from Damascus to open a coffee shop, for example, now they can do everything themselves. Now they can administer the resources. Now they can establish their schools. Now they can finally read and write in the language that they choose to. Before, they were not able to do that. They didn't have the same, some didn't have any citizenship rights, no education in their language. They couldn't read their own language. So now, because the state is not, it does not exist there anymore, you could almost say, people are able to put this into practice. And in a way, the Rojava situation was a test to democratic confederalism because what happened is that, I mean, to be honest, even I was very, very suspicious, thinking, oh, I really hope people don't mess it up, because it's so easy to mess it up when you're at the same time, well, attacked by the Assad regime, and then by jihadists, and especially a system like the Islamic State. It's very difficult to have to create a revolution, a social revolution, in such an intense situation of war. But yet, people have established, parallel to this existential war against the Islamic State, they started opening schools, women's academies and councils, communes. They established the first university, but they don't want to call it a university, they call it an either alternative university or an academy, a social sciences academy, and so on. So this is very remarkable.
We're speaking with Dalar Nurik, a Kurdish PhD student and feminist activist in Germany, about the Rojava revolution in the north of Syria. Again, we apologize for the quality of this audio.
That the people also see this war against the Islamic State not only as a physical existential war against a mentality that just kills everyone that opposes them, kills people just because they don't belong to the same religion or to who have explicitly launched a war on women with their systematic use of sexual violence to degrade the enemy, for example, to dominate. These are very patriarchal understandings of the execution of power. But people don't not only see this war against the Islamic State as an existential physical war, but also as a fight, a struggle to protect the system that they want to create, because in many ways the Islamic State is the complete opposite of what is trying to be created in Rojava, which is pluralistic, secular, gender egalitarian, ecological, and so on. So the fact that the Islamic State was not marginalized as much as the Rojava cantons is really, really remarkable, I think, because for 2 years the Kurdish people have been, not only the Kurdish people, most of them are Kurds, but also the Arabs and the Assyrians in the region, under the umbrella of the Rojava administration, they have been fighting against the Islamic State for 2 years, but they were marginalized so much that they were excluded from major peace conferences like Geneva II. They were refused visas or meetings and so on, and they haven't warned the world about these jihadists and their support from countries like Turkey, Qatar, and Saudi Arabia. But the world, the truth is that countries like European countries, the US, and so on, for a long time benefited from jihadists being in Syria fighting the Assad regime, because the priority was not to have a democratic Syria, the freedom of the people in Syria, but to topple Assad no matter the cost. So when the Geneva 2 conference took place, at the same time, the same day, the people in Rojava actually declared the autonomy for three cantons, Afrin, Jizre, and Kobane. These are now, due to the situation in the war, they're not connected to each other. Some of them are completely, well, Kobane at the moment is completely besieged on the outside by the Islamic State. But these are autonomous cantons that they have announced as cantons, and they are they work under one umbrella, but they all govern themselves autonomously. They have different laws. For example, in Jizre, the Jizre canton, which is the most eastern canton, it is the most multicultural, multi-ethnic, multi-religious of the three. There they have introduced or announced three official languages. The ways in which the administration works is more inclusive, more diverse, pays more attention to sensitivities there. And it is also due to its size and due to its multiculturalism, the one that is the most stable at the moment, whereas the other two have been under very heavy attack by the Islamic State. So of course, when we're talking about this revolution taking place in Rojava, we're not just talking about the revolution in the sense that there's no regime anymore and people are fighting this resistance against the Islamic State, but we're talking about the social elements of this, about the social of revolution that takes place. So because after all, we're talking about a society of people that simply had no concept of what it means to govern your own affairs, to make your own decisions, to decide how to farm your land, what should be taught in school, and just these very basic things. A society in which it is normal sometimes that a child marries, a girl marries a very old man. So it's this kind of society, and we have to define the term revolution with all of that in mind. So of course there will be shortcomings, of course there will be mistakes and so on, but the fact that now in such a society it is always one woman and one man governing, the fact that 40% at least of the administration have to be women, that you have one Kurdish minister, two of the deputies of him or her have to be one Arab, one Assyrian, if the minister is Assyrian, one Arab, one Kurd as a deputy, of which one of them has to be a woman. This is something very, very remarkable, because one of the narratives that are being told about in the Middle East is that due to so much ethnic tension, sectarianism, patriarchy, and so on, which is very, very obvious, yes, this is the reality of the Middle East. The wars, the conflicts are due to unjust wars, imperialist intervention, and regional ethnic tensions and conflicts and sectarianism and so on. That's true. But the fact that it has just been taught in a way that makes the situation look so desperate, as if there could never be an alternative, that this was the destiny of the Middle East, that people will always remain in this stage, and this keeps people, you know, in this in one stage on purpose. So the fact that Rojava, that the people there were able to create such a system with its shortcomings, is still extremely, extremely remarkable, because it also poses a perspective for the people in the Middle East generally. Because the Rojava administration continues to say, we are not seeking an independent state because we oppose the state as an oppressive, inherently dominant system that is incompatible with real democratic values of real freedom, because we cannot establish what was there before and just redefine it as something else. That's not possible. We have to think of an alternative. And you see that alternative not only in the narrative, but also in the practice, the way it is governed, the way it is run, the way decisions are being made. It's very, very different from the regime.
Can I get you to define what the state is? Because it seems like I'm a little confused between what... So Tevdem, can you talk a little bit about Tevdem and how in Rojava, there's been the creation of these councils, but also parallel to that, apparently, like a parliament and presidents. And being that those are structures that are modeled pretty much off of state structures, how does it differ from what you would call a state structure, and what sort of recall powers do the population have against those specific positions, and what are their terms?
Yeah, that's a very good question, actually. Well, I want to repeat first that we have to consider all of that with the fact in mind that this is taking place in a very, very intense war situation. So, in many ways, for example, in Kobani, much of these social elements of the revolution are not taking place at the moment because the whole city has armed itself against the Islamic State. But one of the key differences, I think, between the state, let's say the Syrian state, and what is being created in Rojava, is that the decision-making power is up to the people. So the fact that Tevdem was formed, Tevdem is it's a democratic social movement in a way. So it is not a party. It is not along party lines. It is more about principles, which include gender equality, the inclusion of the peoples and religions there. So this movement aims at being, well, it works closely with these parliamentary structures, obviously, but it's also a mechanism to connect the people with the decision-making process. Because the council movement is primarily aimed at giving people the decision-making power, let's say on a neighborhood level, the people want to decide over how to get rid of their garbage in an ecological way. They know their region the best, so they need to figure it out somehow. So they make the decisions, and committees are formed that implement that. So the same applies to the relationship between Tevdem and the general and the parliament, if you will. Because, I mean, in many ways, this is also going to be a process, because these parliamentary structures, they seem to be the most effective at that time, because you're also working together with other ethnic groups, with other parties, etc. So that seems to be the, I think, the most logical way to proceed at that stage. But these things might change, and the Tevdem movement is a backup to guarantee that the decision-making power will still remain with the people, that the decisions that primarily affect the people will be made by the people, such as things that affect them in their closest environment. So at the same time, the parliament is taking care of more of like external issues of dealing with the politics, with foreign affairs, and so on. So it is I cannot give you a very clear answer, because I'm also not as sure. I would also have to ask, because this is a very good question, actually. So yeah, I don't think I gave you a very satisfying answer, because the way in which the system in Rojava tries to be created is to reshape the understanding of power of the state. So it tries to not resemble the state, but sometimes it actually does resemble the state, either due to the situation at that point, due to the fact that some things have to be very urgently decided and so on. So I think if it wasn't for the war situation, perhaps there would be things would look different as well. Good question, because actually I want to think about that more as well. But this is something that I cannot answer very well, because I'm not there. I don't know how it is exactly. You know what I mean? I would either have to ask somebody who was in the parliament or who was in the Tevdem directly about these kinds of questions. Oh, sorry.
And I guess from your answer earlier concerning the PKK and the PYD and their relationship with each other, is it correct to understand that following the shift towards democratic confederalism, that the PYD was more leaning towards a Marxist-Leninist nationalism like the PKK?
Well, the PYD was actually formed much later. The PYD was formed in 2004.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So, I mean, the Kurds that live in Syria, well, most of the Kurds in the world live in Turkey, And from these four states, the fewest live in Syria. So the Kurds in Syria were always, you know, the smallest group. But the PKK, due to Abdullah Öcalan's presence in Syria for a long time, there was a lot of influence of the PKK in Syria. The people were very much influenced just by the party being present there, the party structures being very well established there. So when this general shift in the PKK took place, it also took place in Syria. But as I said, it's relatively small compared to the population in Turkey. But the PYD was, I think, formed in 2004, and they have ever since been in opposition to the Assad regime. In 2004, actually, the Kamishlo massacre took place, in which several protesters were killed by the regime. So the PYD was, its history cannot be compared to the PKK, because in many ways, before it was formed, it was still in a way part of it. The official formulation, the formation of the PYD took place after that shift in the PKK had taken place. So when the Rojava Revolution was started in 2012, it was the principle from the beginning was not ethno-nationalism, but and also not statehood-oriented liberation concepts, but democratic confederalism. And so the inclusion of the different peoples in the region, the focus on gender equality, and so on, they were there from the beginning, from the start. It's just that, I mean, also, just speaking from my own experience, until 2012, most people, even Kurdish people, had no idea what was happening with the Kurds in Syria, because it was so low profile. You know, the war was always in either in Turkey or something in Iraq or in Iran, but you never heard much about the Kurds in Syria. So the situation happened just one day, really, on the 19th of July. I read in the news the Kurds took over the regions in Syria that they inhabit. And the YPG and the YPJ, the defense forces of Rojava, they have from the beginning also always tried to avoid clashes along ethnic lines, whereas this is something that the Islamic State has often provoked.
We're speaking with Dalar Durik, a Kurdish PhD student and feminist activist in Germany, about the Rojava revolution in the north of Syria. Again, we apologize for the quality of this audio. Along the lines of that question of nationalism, can you talk about, there's a critique that you've leveled a few times about the existence of patriarchy in tandem with nationalism within national liberation movements. What relationship do you see between nationalism, state structures, and patriarchy?
Okay, so, well, nationalism itself, or the concept of the nation, is in many ways it's based on very patriarchal and feudal fantasies of belonging, of collectivity. The way the family structures operate, the way in which the discourse about the nation is formulated, it has in many ways to do with patriarchal assertions of power and domination. So in many national liberation movements, even though, for example, many right-wing fascist movements have co-opted women, have mobilized women on a large scale because they see the they see a benefit in that. They know how they can exploit women for their own purposes. It is inherently an very patriarchal assertion of power. For example, in war situations, very often women, even in Europe, in the States, etc., women were mobilized to work, to do their part for the nation, to their children, etc., for the nation, and everything for the nation, when the men are out there supposedly protecting the nation, protecting the valley, protecting the women, because the women are considered as part of the land that the men have to protect. So, in many national liberation movements, even though some of them were socialists, or they were, they called themselves in one way or another revolutionary, and so on, women's liberation was sometimes even stated as one aim, but it was never actually implemented. The primary cause was always the national liberation, because the oppressor was always determined as the state that oppresses us, this colonizer that oppresses us, or something. So it was always an external enemy, and we need to get rid of them first, and then we'll all be free. But first of all, while the patriarchy is much older than the modern nation state, than capitalism, and so on. So even before, for example, colonizer A was here, the women were not equal or free either. So this idea that freedom will come and then equality will be there has disappointed many, many women in India, in Vietnam, and in Algeria, so, and also in the Kurdish movement as well. Because as I had said earlier, briefly, women had initially joined because they thought this is a cause that will liberate me, because this is a socialist cause that commits to gender equality, but then the realities then were that many men simply did not accept them as equal comrades, as equal fighters, or equal people. So that is why the decision was taken to organize autonomously. Because of the experience of discrimination, of oppression in the armed ranks, because, I mean, it's something very disappointing to see that the movement that you commit to, a promise to liberation, oppresses you because you are a woman. That is why it was important to mobilize autonomously, because otherwise your rights will be compromised. And what we saw in the last years in the countries in which the so-called Arab Spring took place is that many women were so active in protesting and organizing and so on, because in many cases, due to multiple layers of oppression, women have a very big interest in getting rid of the oppressor, seeking an alternative, because they are very often threatened or, you know, violated by the system more than men, due to the patriarchy of the state and the patriarchy of the community and so on. So, but at the same time, because the discourse was always, no, we have to get rid of the dictator first, regardless of what comes after that, many women's rights were compromised, and sometimes the situation got even worse. So this is something very sad, and this is something very disappointing for women. And the fact that for the Kurdish people, this moment of revolution or the moment of liberation never came, or at least not in that same way in which, for example, the tyrant can fall overnight, this process made people realize, well, no, this has to change. We cannot do that. We have an enemy, as one activist has said. There's also an enemy inside, which is the patriarchy in our own community, in our own movement, in our own comrades, for example.
How does the Democratic Union Party infrastructure deal with activities and practices of communities within the three cantons that don't sign into the partnership with the PYD and whose actions run counter to PYD positions?
The way in which the cantons in Rojava are administered, or the way in which generally the democratic movement is run, is with the insistence of being non-partisan. So, but for example, the defense forces, the YPG and the YPJ, even though most of the people are, you know, they would, you know, identify as supporters of the PYD, the insistence is that the defense forces do not represent one party. And the same with the Tevdem movement, with the social, with the democratic movement of the society. It is important to emphasize that it is not partisan. The truth is, the reality is that, these ideas, these mechanisms, these structures that are being built have much to do with the ideology of the PYD. But at the same time, the PYD aims to step back a little bit and say, well, this is not our system, this is something that we want to create together. Because, I mean, many people that are Arabs, Assyrians, for example, have their own parties, and many Kurdish people have their own parties, and so on. So actually, the charter, the social contract charter, for example, was drafted in cooperation with all of these parties. So the structures, the way in which the places are run, the councils, for example, First of all, nobody's forced to take part in them. This is something voluntary, obviously. This is a social movement, so you don't have to subscribe to it. But it is, the people insist that this has to be non-partisan, otherwise it will be just the domination of one party. But there are so many parties, you cannot just impose one party's ideas on it. But the truth is, yeah, ideologically, these are based on the PKK-PYD principle. Well, the KDP, which is the Kurdistan Democratic Party, which is the party that is ruling in the Kurdistan regional government in the KRG in northern Iraq or south Kurdistan, they are more along this nationalist capitalist line. They also enjoy the support of Turkey, of the US, for example. While they try to assert their own line in Rojava, a more nationalist line, a more line that would be in favor of Turkey. This was when there were several hostilities between the Rojava, the PYD, and the KDP, the KDP. But recently that has stepped back a little bit due to the crisis of this year with all the rise of the Islamic State and so on. But that was basically the main source of opposition, was the attempts of the KDP to form their parties there. So in fact, their media practice also spread a lot of what later turned out to be false information about stuff that was happening inside Moldova and so on. So it is very difficult to assess. But basically, what I want to say is that this system, the council movements, the cooperatives, and so on, these are social structures, and they're not binding to anyone. And the YPG, the Women's Defense Force and the People's Defense Authority, they also say that they're not partisan, and so on. So the system that is created in Rojava is not a domination of the PYD. It has explicitly been the constitution, the formulation of the system, the integration of different peoples and ethnic and religious groups into the system was a cooperation of all of the parties together, of the different representatives of the Assyrians, of the Arabs, etc., which were not at that time part of the PYD.
Maybe what I was trying to ask, but that, sorry to cut you off, was in the lecture that you gave, Stateless Democracy, How the Kurdish Women Movement Liberated Democracy from the State, you ended up briefly touching on a few cultural and religious practices that were illegalized, basically, in Rojava. And can you talk about what those practices were? And you mentioned before the marriage of, 12-year-old girls to old men, but a few other things, and also how that's been implemented?
So, I mean, I see what you mean now. Sorry, I didn't catch.
I worded it poorly, so.
It's fine. So, one of the first things that the administration did when in 2012, they announced that they will now govern themselves. In 2013, the first laws, etc., were articulated, was one of the first things, and I was very, very happy to read that, was to criminalize certain practices such as child marriage, honor killings, forced marriages, and then bride, which is different from dowry. Bride price is when a girl is married, her husband, well, the family of the husband has to pay the girl's family in a way to reimburse them for losing labor, which is, you know, almost the same as selling somebody. So that, and then I mentioned child marriage, domestic violence, and so on. So I mean this, and also the fact, the men that are known for being violent, for using domestic violence, they cannot be part of the administration either. So these are for that kind of society, for Kurdish society, these are very, very radical things. The fact that your administration forbids you something that you consider as normal because of your privilege, that of course hurts very macho pseudo understandings of, you know, what the family or what the society should look like. But the fact that the Rojava administration, from the beginning, made no compromises with certain things. I mean, this is not to be confused with being authoritarian or anything. These are things such as not allowing children to get married. So when it comes to women's rights, especially, or not women's rights, but women's freedom, certain things were simply not compromised. So does that mean that it means that it will not be practiced? No. That's why, for example, Tehran, well, that's why the women's councils, academies, cooperatives, and so on, educational seminars, that's why they are there to turn these things such as co-presidency, quotas, the criminalization of violence against women, to make these things actually mean something rather than just being something written somewhere. That's why this social revolution is there. That's why the social movement is there, to empower people in a meaningful way, to give women the chance to work in cooperatives, for example, to be economically independent, to give them the opportunity to go to school, to read, their rights, to have an education, and so on. Because this is how you actually change the society. You don't just change it, like you say, you cannot beat the people in your house. So these are very positive things, but as I say, they will only remain bureaucratic if you don't actually do something to change the mentality of the society. I think in the email you had mentioned genital mutilation, but that doesn't happen in Rojava.
Oh, I thought, I'm sorry, I thought that you had said that that was one of the things that was made illegal in that lecture, so my mistake.
Yeah, no, I mean, it would be, because that's also violence against women, but I don't think it's a practice that is practiced there. In the four parts of Kurdistan, female genital mutilation is only recorded in Iraqi Kurdistan. So, as far as I know, there is no female genital mutilation in Iraq.
That is something that in the U.S. media, though, has been attributed to Islamic State. And I'm not sure if that's, because I know it's not like, my understanding, not being a Muslim and not growing up in a Muslim society or around a lot of Muslims, is that it's very much not something that's Quranic or like cultural within Islam. It's more of a tribal practice, and that's the basis for it. Is that fair?
Well, I really don't, cause I'm not very familiar with emergence of, I mean, I don't know where female genital mutilation comes from, because I'm sure, I mean, many people use religion to legitimize it. They find some kind of legitimation in religious texts. But I mean, many of the countries in, what's mostly a problem that they say is taking place in Africa rather than in Muslim countries. More correct to say it happens in Africa rather than saying it's happening in Muslim countries, because many African countries in which female genital mutilation is taking place are actually majority Christian countries, so such as I think Ethiopia and Eritrea.
Trigger warning: in this next segment, we talk about the allegations of female genital mutilation against the IS in some detail.
So it is. I really cannot say something very clear about it, but the way in which discourse is, of course, changed is to portray these kinds of countries, Middle East, North Africa, generally something associated with Islam, as backward and primitive and incompatible with democratic values and progress. But the truth is, it is a very, very brutal form of violence against women. It's one of the most ultimate ways of controlling a woman's body, because you are cutting out her sexuality in a way, physically. So it is a very feudal, patriarchal practice, because you are saying this woman is only there to serve her husband. You sue her genitals together after you cut off the part that caused pleasure. If you deny her pleasure, you also, when she gets married and then she has sex with her husband, she has to actually rip her genitals off. I mean, this is very difficult, something very difficult to talk about. So that just means that she's only there to be an instrument of her husband. So this is a very, very patriarchal practice, very feudal practice, because it also means she's only there to pass on the genes, to be a birthing machine, basically. So, I mean, this is nothing that is, I mean, people use different religious texts to justify this at the heart of the system, patriarchal control. And it is, I think the Islamic State practicing female genital mutilation, actually that's one news article that later on turned out that was actually false, that wasn't actually true, that they had issued a fatwa like that. So, I mean, people were like, well, that's probably very likely, and people believed it, because that is something that the Islamic State would do. And I think in other occasions they have done it. But at that time, when it was announced that they issued a fatwa against women for female genital mutilation, it wasn't actually true. But it was compatible with people's ideas about the Islamic State. And it's very dangerous to not frame the real threat that the Islamic State poses. It is a very, very big threat. But it is very important to not frame it in a way that is delegitimizing what many people believe in, or and I couldn't really say it in the way I wanted to say it. It is important to not be against Islamic State in this Islamophobic way, and by feeding into existing Islamophobia, which is also part of the reason why the Islamic State is so successful, because they exploit that fear of Islamophobia. So that's why it's very, very important to be very sensitive with these kinds of issues, because otherwise the real suffering of women, the real threat that the Islamic State poses, will just be co-opted for very racist or chauvinist, imperialist agendas, similar to how Kurdish women are portrayed now, to legitimize foreign intervention to fight the Islamic State and say, we're doing this for these women. But nobody actually asks what these women want. They don't actually want anybody to intervene in the law. So it's really interesting how
There's so much that comes out in the media in the English language that is simply Islamophobic and that does paint with a very broad palette in a way that serves the interest of the state and also in the United States. This week on The Final Straw, Burst spoke with Dalar Durek. You can find writings by Dalar at http://dilar91.blogspot.com. Next week's show will be the second half of our conversation on the Rojava Revolution and Kurdish women's movement. Asheville Free Media, ashevillefm.org. This is The Final Straw, and I'm Bursa Goodness. The show can also be heard on KXCF in Marshall, California, KWTF out of Bodega Bay, California, KOWALP out of Olympia, Washington, and WCRSLP in Columbus, Ohio. Archives of this show can be found a week after airing at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org, and you can contact us for comments or questions at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net.